and books are at least implicitly of this sort. They aren't explicit, as I say. Paul does not follow this pattern explicitly in his materials, but implicitly, for example, in, say, 2 Corinthians, you have a series of problems dealt with. Say, the church has certain problems, so Paul addresses the first problem, the second problem, the third problem, the fourth problem, the fifth problem. It's like pearls on a string, so you could have that kind of thing. But these are bound together, because there's a common current running through all of these. And this current may be focused in terms of this concept of contrast. But the New Covenant, the Jesus of the New Covenant, and all that he is and does and stands for is better, are better than the Old Covenant. Now, when you have contrasts, and recurring contrasts, you have to ask such questions as these. What is the meaning of each of these contrasts? What differences are stressed? Now, the emphasis here is on the stress. What differences are stressed? Now, by the way, in answering the first question, which of course you eventually have to do, not at this stage, but eventually, what you need to do is get the meaning of each of the components and then what the differences between them are. In other words, yeah, let's use symbols here. If you have X versus Y, in order to get the meaning of the contrast between these, you have to ask, what is the meaning of X? What is the meaning of Y? And third, what are the differences between X and Y? See, those are the three stages of getting the meaning of contrasts. And then why does... I guess I've left out... the author stressed these differences. I've left out the author stressed these differences. Why the emphasis, and I'm zeroing in now on the main difference is stressed. Why the emphasis on the fact that Christ is better? Why the recurring use of contrast? See, contrast could be done in terms of a single contrast. In other words, you could have here the description of the Old Covenant. Let's just use some chapters hypothetically, say 1 through 6. And then here in 7, let's use the number of chapters you have in Hebrews, you have a description of the New Covenant and of Christ. So you have a single contrast in effect. But here you have these contrasts used recurringly. So why does he use these contrasts recurringly? It's very interesting now how he does it and why he does it throughout. And then the implicational question, which I often abbreviate if I'm asking implications, what implications of the answers to these questions.
Do you include contrast on Abraham on that?
There is a contrast between Abraham and, because they're talking about chapter 7.
Abraham and Christ.
There is an implicit contrast there, but that's not a major one, of a major order, the ones that we've noted here. And here we go to the third criterion that we mentioned yesterday by way of getting at what's primary, and that is distinctiveness. Because what is distinctive, most distinctive here has to do, and the second criterion, significance, what is most significant and distinctive has to do with the contrast between the old order and the new order, particularly by way of emphasizing how Jesus is better. Now, what's significant in 7 is not Abraham, but rather Melchizedek. In other words, Abraham's relation to Melchizedek, and Jesus being a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, not after the order of Aaron. So actually, it's the Melchizedek versus Aaron, and Jesus belonging to the order of Melchizedek versus the Aaronic order that is the main contrast there. The other is subordinate. Not as significant, not as distinct. So you need to differentiate between those contrasts in this case that are of most significance and are most distinctive over against those that are subordinate, auxiliary, and not as distinctive.
In the point that Abraham is the patriarch that a Jew would say was central, and the only way seems to get to Abraham is through Melchizedek.
Yeah.
And therefore, if you can get to him through Melchizedek, you say that Jesus is at the same order. You have jumped to say that Christ is is above Abraham.
He doesn't argue that, you see, that's not his point. His argument, his whole argument has to do with Jesus' supremacy, since he's a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, over the Aaronic order, and over the law. Abraham is used incidentally. You might think, well, he should have used Abraham more prominently, because Abraham, of course, is a prime character in the Old Covenant. But he doesn't argue Abraham, because, of course, the issue is not Abraham, you see. The issue is the whole Levitical system. That's the issue here. The whole book stresses that, you see. The whole issue is that these people apparently have an attachment not to Abraham. In other words, their argument is not the kind of argument you have in Galatians, you know, where in effect the readers are saying, we're sons of Abraham, and it's because we are sons of Abraham in the physical sense that we are heirs of the promise made to Abraham, and the sure sign of that is physical circumcision, as well as physical descendancy, you see, that kind of thing. That's not the argument here. The argument here has to do with attachment to the whole Levitical system, which is post-Abrahamic. But in order to indicate the supremacy of Jesus to that whole post-Abrahamic Mosaic Levitical system, what he does is to have to go back to Melchizedek, but to go back to Melchizedek and make Melchizedek meaningful, he has to show how Abraham acted toward Melchizedek. See, but that's merely a means to an end. The end has to do with this whole business of Jesus' relationship and his superiority, to be more precise, to the Levitical system, which is Mosaic and post-Abrahamic. So that's the issue here. Not the Abrahamic covenant, but the Sinaitic covenant. See, that's why I say it's the emphasis on Abraham is merely a means to an end. The thing that's most prominent and most distinctive has to do with the Levitical system, the Sinaitic covenant. That's, you see what's happening here. We're getting into chapter 7. You see, that's why I say that ultimately this thing has got to be tested by the analysis of the particulars. And that's one reason why it's hard sometimes to survey this kind of literature as a whole, because you have twists and turns in the thought, and if you don't follow them somewhat, you don't have to follow them precisely and completely, but if you don't follow them somewhat, you'll get lost, and you don't know what's here in the whole. That simply underlines both the methodology of survey as far as this kind of thing is concerned, but also the tentativeness of your results. They're subject to change or completion as you go into the parts of the channel. So test me out on this and see if I'm correct in my analysis of
something. You're the
owner. I do not assure you that I always am. I hope I usually am. At least what we strive for. Or approximation of the ideal. I don't realize. Now, the issue is whether there are certain contrasts that bind these materials together beyond the argumentative and hortatory units that we found. And I would say there are. And so I would tend to break this book down, and we have a list of these others here. I would simply go on and list these others. This causation by interchange would be number 2, and your returns of contrast would be number 3. There are units which are bound together involving both argumentative and hortatory materials in terms of recurring thoughts. The contrast suggests that the main theme has to do with the superiority of Jesus over the Old Covenant, as 1:1-4 indicates, very outset. But there are the following emphases with regard to this superiority. In 1:5 through chapter 4. Now there are links between these units. As you find in Paul, there are transitions here, so the breaks are not absolute and stark. But I would say through chapter 4, you have the emphasis on the superiority of Jesus' person as the Son and the High Priest. Focuses on the person of Jesus. And there are two emphases, as over against angels, which dominates the first 2 chapters, and as over against Moses, which is what Sam was calling to our attention at the beginning of 3, implicitly also as over against Joshua, who did not give the people rest in the land of Canaan. So we might add Joshua here as well. That's a very, very interesting passage there in relation to rest and its fact that it was not realized. Now, at the very end of 4, and even earlier, he begins to introduce the concept of Jesus as high priest. An emphasis in 5 to 7 is on the superiority of Jesus' high priesthood. Particularly in terms of his high priestly order. Superiority of the order of Melchizedek, which is the order of Christ's high priesthood, as over against the order of Aaron, Levi. You see the contrast? Jesus versus angels, Moses, Joshua, Jesus, Melchizedek versus Aaron, Levi, law. And then in 8 following, you have the superiority of Jesus' sanctuary. There, beginning of 8, he gets into the heavenly sanctuary as over against the earthly sanctuary. He is covenant, the superiority of the new covenant, on the basis of which he ministers. It's over against the old covenant. It's what the Levites had to minister with. And, in more general terms, his whole ministry. Here, the emphasis is on his high priesthood in terms of his high priestly order. Here, his high priesthood in terms of the actual ministry. Based on supremacy of his person, that's why I say it's cumulative, based on supremacy of his order, based on supremacy of the sanctuary in which he ministers, the heavenly, not the earthly, based on supremacy of the covenant, on the basis of which he ministers, his ministry is superior. And so his concluding exhortations are, in effect, take advantage of this superior ministry, based as it is on this superior Jesus. And all these contrasts that you find here. Those seem to be the three main emphases involved in this matter of contrast. Now, as I've explained to the other classes, the way in which you find these units is by recurrence, normally. Not always, but recurrence. In other words, you have beginning with one God. In fact, there are transitions here, so he actually begins earlier, and he even introduces the angels in 1:4, but they become prominent and dominant in 1:5 following. He begins to contrast Jesus to the angels, and that contrast recurs, as I said, through the first two chapters, and then he begins with Moses in chapter 3, and continues with Joshua here, and then in 5, although he introduces the high priesthood here, particularly at the end of 4, he begins with this matter of these two orders. The emphasis on the high priesthood, he does that recurringly here until he comes here where he moves to the sanctuary. So for example, when you look at 8, you find that he says, now, the point in what we are saying is this, and I think maybe this is what you had in mind talking to me, Wes. Is this the statement you had in mind?
About 8:1.
8:1, yeah. We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven. And by the way, this motif of Jesus' session in heaven is a recurring motif, as you saw here. He picks it up here in relation to the sanctuary. A minister in the sanctuary and the true tent. See how we begin the discussion as a matter of sanctuary? Which is set up not by man, but by the Lord. See the contrast. The human is over against the divine. And then he goes on to talk about the two sanctuaries and the supremacy of the heavenly sanctuary. And then he gets into the matter of the covenant in verse 6. But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry which is much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better. He talked about the new covenant in Jeremiah, which is introduced because the old covenant failed. And he continues with that new covenant, old covenant, new covenant contrast, and also the ministry of Jesus in terms of the sacrifice. By the way, you could add a sacrifice here, the superiority of Jesus' sacrifice, other sacrifices. I haven't really included that ministry, but do that. And throughout here, the superiority of this ministry is a result, the mediation is a result of all of these elements of supremacy that you find in these materials.
In my first division, I got from 4:14, of course, I don't know why I put those two verses with the first section and the second section to the first. But I got a division.
I tell you why, Wes, and that's what I indicated here, and that is your 414. Since then, we have a great high priest.
Okay.
That's the emphasis of 5:1 following. The emphasis previously has to do primarily with the supremacy of this person. Now he's picking up the high priesthood motif. As I say, he begins here. These are your transitions. And always when you have transitions, your question is, on which side of the bridge do you place them? You know, you have these bridge statements. So you're in good company. I can cite some good scholars that would support you here.
All right, now, in the major units, I didn't break between 7 and 8. I went all the way to 1039, but then in my subunits, I broke at 7 and 8.
Yeah.
And but then, the reason I broke at 1039 on the major units, because I seemed like that the high priesthood of Christ was a subject that ended there and went into faith, and let us act on this faith. And it kind of went into another motif, it seemed like. The high priesthood of Christ was not a predominant thing in this particular session, chapter 11 through 1321. But you had it together.
Yeah.
You wouldn't break it there at 11?
No, I wouldn't. Let me briefly indicate why, without giving too much away, because I want you to get the material yourself. But you'll note that the element of faith is introduced immediately in 1019 following, in that oratory material. In fact, you find it in 1022, let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith. Now, faith is critical to the course of action which he indicates here, which flows from what he has said with regard to this ministry of Christ. You see, since we have confidence in 19 to enter the sanctuary, this new sanctuary, not the old one, but the new one, by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way which he's opened up for us through the curtain, that is, through his flesh, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, so that brings to bear now all of this, what he's been saying here. The whole thing is cumulative, not only in 8:1 following, but goes back, it picks up the whole book in a sense. Then comes the exhortation. Here's where you have causal elements preceding. You see, we had cause here, we raised it. But here we have causal elements preceding the exhortation. See? Then you have the exhortation in 22. Let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. By the way, this particularizes that he came to make purification for sins. And note this matter of the purification of the conscience, emphasizing sanctification as well as justification, that particularizes that statement. And then you have another exhortation in 23, let us hold fast the perfection of our hope without wavering. Now you have substantiation, for he who promised is faithful, etc. I don't want to give you too much here. Now, note that at the end of that chapter, he returns to the matter of faith, and it has to do with this whole business of confidence, of perseverance, not wavering, etc.
35.
I'm sorry, 39. I've got writing all over this place that covers the verses references. 39. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who have faith and keep their souls. Now what he's going to do is to go back and pick up examples of those who have faith. He wants them to have faith. See? Now this is not argument, see, Sam. This is not argument in these materials. This is simply illustration. This is not polemic. This is illustration. And then he comes back to it in 12. With the next exhortation. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely. Let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. See the links there? Faith is the link between 10:19 following in chapter 10 and chapter 11 and the beginning of chapter 12, which leads then into the whole business of perseverance on the basis of a proper understanding of what these hardships mean. Sorry, you see how the whole thing is tied together? You see why I hesitate to break the thing up, Wes? Things are linked so closely together that it's not really a break. Rather, what he's really doing is in the hortatory materials, which is indicated on the board, begin with 1019, in 11, what he's doing is really substantiating by particularizing faith and defining faith, or maybe a better word is describing faith, by giving you these examples of faith from the Old Covenant, incidentally, all the faith of the Old Covenant. And in a way he's saying, now if these people with the Old Covenant, which is inferior, had faith, you have even more reason for faith. Because, ultimately, you have Jesus, who is the author and perfecter of faith, whom these people did not have, see? So this is part of the substantiatory pattern within the hortatory materials. That's why I said 10:19 to 13:21 is really exhortation. The argument, or the polemic, is in 8:1 to 10:18 as far as these instances are concerned. You don't have polemic after 10:19. You have substantiation, exhortations, illustrations, etc., but not polemic. At least that's the way I would view it. Well, when did this thing go off, Wes?
Is it off?
Didn't click. Okay. Well, I might have to have your help again.
Okay.
Supplementing what I have. I try to listen, but we have several clicks here. So I can't tell if my click or your click is going off. Okay, what we'll do now in terms of a pattern here normally is run until about 2:10 or 2:15. Let's run 5 more minutes and then take our break and then continue. Is that all right?
Dr. Trenet, you mentioned 10:19 is the faith is the critical course of action, but he's really, of course, you did speak about recurrence too, but he's had faith all the way through.
Oh, yes.
Like in 3, the issue is they heard the good news, but it didn't benefit them because it didn't reach with faith in the hearers. Yeah. So, like if you were to study this book from a thematic point of view, it's really all the way through one of the issues, isn't it?
Yes. That
do you respond in faith, or do you?
Right. Although faith is used in various ways, it's used in a somewhat different sense in 3 and 4, as over against what you have here in terms of perseverance, the faith that perseveres. It's over against the faith that believes God. Uh-huh. Back in 3 and 4. So faith is looked at in terms of various facets, but that would emerge. In relation to picking up all the recurring contrasts. So we indicated just some of them. And we focused on Jesus, and of course the focus is on him in this book. But one of the recurring contrasts, of course, that you have here, that's highlighted, for example, in 3 and 4, is the contrast between those who have faith and those who do not have faith. And of course, you have a contrast between what the Israelites were in the wilderness and what these Hebrews ought to be. Don't be like these Israelites. They did not believe, but you ought to believe. And of course, that belief is part of the Sabbath rest of God that he's talking about in 3 and 4. So you do have faith recurring here within a number of contexts here in terms of contrast, particularly as regards contrasts with regard to readers, perfect readers, is over against Jesus. This is where we will focus.
The thing that I was concerned about was in the exhortations there in chapter 13.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't confuse me. These exhortations seem significantly different from the other, where you would have argumentation, exhortation. It seemed like exhortations to on how to relate to each other. You don't have that until 13. Why would 13 not be an independent section there?
Well, the question is whether you do or don't have exhortations of a similar sort. Look, for example, at 10:24. Let us consider how to stir up one another with love and good work, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some. So I have a suspicion that when you get what's behind these exhortations, well, for example, let brotherly love continue, 13:1, which ties up very closely the one I just read. When you get behind these exhortations, get the meaning and ask why does he make these exhortations, I think what you find out is that following these courses of action, which he's laid down here, will help them with regard to these other courses of action he's indicated previously. But they really are bound up together. They aren't separate and isolated, but are bound up together. They're pieces of the same fabric, the same way of life. Now, for example, take this matter of not being led away in 13:9 by diverse and strange teachings. Well, obviously, that's what he's been talking about all along. In fact, he begins, as we shall see, when we get into the rest of chapter 1, one of the strange teachings has to do with angels. And either that angels are superior to Jesus and ought to be worshipped, and Jesus ought not to be worshipped, or angels are superior to Jesus, and because you don't worship angels, you therefore shouldn't worship Jesus. He's inferior to them. See, well, that's strange teachings. So, and then he goes on, of course, to talk about this matter of the sin offering, which is burned outside the camp in 10 and 11, and there's and then he goes about talking about suffering. So Jesus also suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify the people through his own blood. Therefore, let us go forth to him outside the camp, bearing abuse for him. That whole business of suffering, that's what he's been talking about in chapter 12, you see. Which we'll get into the occasion of the writing here as we move along. But there's no question about what these people were suffering. Suffering probably at the hands of Jews who did not like the fact that they had moved away from Judaism, from the Old Covenant, and accepted Christ in the New Covenant. With all the implications that follow from that, such as, for example, what he suggests at the end of 8, namely, the moment you do this, then the Old Covenant is obsolete and near to vanishing away. Now, you say that to a Jew, and it's like waving a red flag in front of a bull. So that's what you have in the book of the Acts. The initial persecutors, and in a sense, the greatest persecutors of the Christian church, were not Roman heathens. They were Jews. That's, the book of the Acts is full of that kind of thing. So, the great thrust then, the great pressure on these people, was to ask, now, do we really need to move away from the Old Covenant? And move to this New Covenant? Is not the Old Covenant really sufficient? Why get persecuted for nothing if the Old Covenant is sufficient? So this whole business of persecution tied up with these strange doctrines. You know, the Old Covenant is final, sufficient. You don't really need Christ. In fact, when you look at Christ, you find out that he's less than Abraham. So why worry about worshiping him? There's plenty of angelology around, angel worship around. Let's worship the angels. Forget about Christ. And then we won't persecute you. You'll avoid all the pain. You get all the pleasure. It comes from genuine Judaism. Okay? These things, I think, are all bound up together, I suspect, and are not as separate as they seem to be, I'm sure. Well, let me just wind up with strategic areas here, and then I think we'll go on and bring up other matters later on as far as the key for writing problems, etc. As we move along, I've indicated already some things here. Now, some strategic areas and the reasons for them. You always ought to give reasons for them. Obviously, if you have a general statement that covers the whole of the book, you have a strategic area. By the way, this is comparable to summarization. We indicated summarization is one of the laws which directly indicate the presence of a strategic area. That's strategic for that reason. Also because it's representative of the contrast that occurs throughout the book. In fact, it's the key contrast. Then you have a number of other areas representative of the contrast that indicate Jesus' superiority in various of these areas that we've mentioned here. And I've listed the passages 2:14 to 18, 7:15 to 28, 8:1 to 7, 9:11 to 10:10. One could abbreviate that somewhat in terms of the materials. That's found in argumentative materials. And then the third kind of thing would be representative of recurrent exhortations, particularly those bound up with Christ's high priestly work. That's not true of 2:1 to 4. It is true of 4:14 to 26. It is true of 10:19 to 25. In a way, those two are representative of the exhortations that you have here bound up with this supremacy of Christ and the New Covenant. So those are some choices. One ought to keep the choices down in terms of numbers. If you get too many, then the selection of these strategic areas doesn't have much meaning. So one ought to be selective in the process. And one ought to try to choose those areas which relate to the major laws of structure, as we've just indicated here.
I'm sorry, would you just, the second major category of strategic areas, what were those called?
They represented the contrasts indicating Jesus' superiority in these various areas.
Yeah.
So it's person, high priesthood, sanctuary, etc.
Yeah.
And then the final one has to do with exhortations. This gets us to what the author is presenting here by way of beginning to face the real problem of this epistle. As the Interpreter's Bible commentary on Hebrews indicates. By the way, he's presented here in a threefold role as prophet, one through whom God speaks, spokesman on behalf of God, priest, and king, exalted king. The real problem is to explain Jesus' humiliating sufferings and death. That's the critical problem in the book of Hebrews. How can one... How can one who became a man to begin with, therefore sub-divine, and who was mistreated as he was, how can that one be the supreme Christ, the supreme Son of God, who functions as he's described here as the ultimate prophet, as the high priest, and as the divine king? How can, how in the world can you reconcile this description of the Son with the facts of the incarnation and the crucifixion? Well, his thesis is that these things are inseparable. You cannot have one without the other. In these opening verses, he binds creation and redemption indissolubly together. The divine creative energy and nature are in the redemptive process. Now, what he'll have to demonstrate is that the redemptive process is what it is because it must be what it is. It cannot be otherwise. You must have a high priest for redemption. And you cannot have a high priest without the incarnation and all that that means. And you cannot have redemption and the high priestly function without the involvement of deity. As we shall see, as he goes on to argue with regard to the angels and other matters, the temptation was to place Christ somehow in an inferior position because he became incarnate and underwent humiliation and suffering and the cruel crucifixion of the cross. And he argues that does not make him inferior. That is a necessary process of redemption in which divine being himself engages, which in fact makes him superior. And the interesting thing is here, the sequence of what he has said, particularly in terms of making purification for sins and then sitting down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. The same sequence you have again in Philippians 2, as William Wolfe puts in his book on atonement, no cross, no crown. You cannot have exaltation without first having humiliation. So far from demeaning Christ, his humiliation is the road to his exaltation. Sure, he was exalted to begin with prior to the incarnation. But his incarnation and his humiliation is the road back to his exaltation. So no cross and no crown, and that applies to us as it did to Christ. No cross, no crown. Maybe we ought to reflect on that in the midst of an age in which there is so much emphasis on success theology. If you're a servant of God, you'll have health, wealth, prosperity, and all of the good things of life and none of the bad things. No cross, no crown. So he begins to open up the whole thesis of the book. But apparently this lies at the heart of the problem of the reader.
Did you say also, doctrine, no, without the incarnation, no priesthood either?
Oh yes, that he clearly argues. You see the beginning of chapter 5. And we'll see why that's necessary. Why both priesthood is necessary and why incarnation is necessary for priesthood. In fact, he begins arguing that at the end of chapter 4. And he's leading up to that in chapter 2. The whole thing is bound together. But he begins the high priesthood concept at the end of 4 and then begins seriously dealing with that whole issue in chapter 5. Okay, any other questions or comments on this? If not, we'll break now and begin tomorrow. And remember now, I let you out early the first day. Today we want to do two things. First of all, to survey the book as a whole. And then having done that, to move to the study of the second portion of chapter 1, namely 1:5-14. As far as the materials of the book are concerned, we've indicated already that the general materials are ideological, or logical, or discursive in character. And unless you have questions on chapter titles, which are not easy to frame at times with material like this, as you probably discovered, we'll move on to structure. So let me pause to ask, do you have any questions about giving chapter titles to a book like this? Okay. If not, let's move then to structure, which involves two things. One, and we don't necessarily do them in this sequence. Sometimes the order is reversed. Sometimes you do some of one and some of the other. But the two things we're trying to do in structure is look for the major units called divisions, and if possible, subunits of the book. And then to find the major laws operative in the book as a whole, along with the materials with which they're used. And then in conjunction with those laws, we need to ask what we call structural questions. And you've been given samples of those. We'll find that those questions are elemental questions. We'll elaborate on them further. But we need to ask structural questions about each of the primary laws and the materials with which they're used. So let's move to that task. And I'll begin by indicating what we've already suggested here, namely that what we call the prescript, and incidentally, epistles normally have some kind of prescript, as we discovered yesterday, or indicated yesterday. The prescript here is quite different from the usual epistle, but it is a prescript of sorts, a prologue, and then some kind of postscript. Now, the relationship between the prescript and the remaining materials in the book as a whole, and by the way, the prescript does involve the book as a whole, and not merely the opening of the book, usually entails the law of preparation in some form. Now, if that's all you have, if that's the only way you can identify it, then of course you stop there. But sometimes you can identify the law more precisely. Now, the more precise identification includes preparation, but it involves other relationships which are more specific. And in this case, as we indicated, you have preparation here, but it's preparation, you want to put it this way, by particularization. In other words, here you have the general concept set forth, namely the finality and supremacy. They're both emphasized, particularly the latter, the finality and supremacy of the revelation in Christ Jesus, in the Son, which is then specified or particularized in these coming materials. And in the process of particularizing this general motif here, what the author does is to support it or substantiate it. So you have preparation by particularization with substantiation. That's, if you want the fullest way of describing the relationship, that's the fullest way. Now, in a sense, we could simply say particularization with substantiation, and assume that in particularization, as they say, when you move from the general to the particular, you're always engaged in preparation, because the general statement prepares you for the particulars. And that it gives you the main motif of those particulars, and helps you to understand the particulars, and is in turn illuminated by the particulars. Now, let me clarify something at this stage, because some are having problems with this matter of particularization or generalization. In a case of this sort, you do not have both particularization and generalization. Particularization involves a movement from a general statement, not generalization. But now I've told you that. General statement to particulars. So it isn't generalization and particularization. This is particularization. Move from the general to the particulars. Now, if the process is reversed, the order is reversed, you have particulars first, moving then to a general statement, you have generalization. You don't have them together. Involve the two components in reverse order. So I've had some students put down generalization and particularization, by which way they mean a general followed by the particulars, but the two are different. Are we clear on that? Now, we've already indicated the specific materials that are involved here. And in many of these cases, we'll do things orally and not put them on the board, but we've indicated specific materials. And stating specific materials ought to be done in such a way, in surveying the book as a whole or a part as a whole, that you clarify what you have in mind by the relationship. You also support its primacy. Or to give enough evidence to indicate that it is indeed primary, in terms of those criteria we gave you yesterday, the dominant one being it's controlling the unit as a whole, and not merely a part of the unit, at least an insignificant part of the unit. And you ought to give references. For example, here, the general statement is in 1:1-4, and then the particulars are in 1:5 following. Then, for those of you that haven't worked with us in the past, I would immediately, upon recording this law, ask the structural questions that need to be asked in order to get the meaning of this relationship. Because you're observing relationships in order to find out what the author is conveying through their use. So simply to observe them is pointless. What you want to do is get at the meaning of the purpose for their use. So let's illustrate here. And these questions are similar to those on your pages with regard to particularization and generalization. What is the meaning of each statement in the general unit? 1:1-4. How is the general statement particularized in 1:5 following? Now you're asking these questions here, not answering, you understand? Simply preparing for the examination of the parts. What is the meaning of each of the particularizations? And by the way, I've identified these questions as to kind. This is the definitive question. And there's no way of getting at the meaning of the law without getting at the meaning of each of the components when you have two or more components in the law. So when you have a law like particularization, which involves a general statement and particular statements, you have to get at the meaning of the general statement, the meaning of the particular statements, and then the relationship between them. We've used the modal form of the definitive question here, the how form of the question. How is the general statement particularized in 1.5 following? What is the meaning of each of the particularizations? See, we move now to the second component, particulars, and asked about the meaning there. And now we're using a modal question to get at meanings here and the significance of the use of the question, of the law, I should say. How does the general statement illuminate the particulars and vice versa? Because that's the function. The reason why any of us make a general statement before we give particulars is to help to enlighten or bring light to the particulars, and in turn you use the particulars to illuminate the general statement. And then the rational question, why does the author use particularization as he does? Now you know we've used three kinds of questions in a certain sequence: your definitive, rational, and we'll use the implicational question later on. We haven't yet used it. We'll use that later on after we look at the other law we have here, namely substantiation. How do the statements of 1.5 following substantiate 1.1 to 4 as to the finality and supremacy of the Son? Why such substantiation? And then we ask the implicational question about all of these questions and their answers. What are the full implications of the answers to these questions? See the pattern that we follow? We ask about the meaning of each of these, and then the meaning of the relationship, and the reason for the relationship, why, and then the implications of what you discover from the answers to these questions. We have three kinds of questions then. The definitive, sometimes asked in the modal form, in the how form, the rational and the implicational questions. And if you look at those pages that we gave you, you'll find that those are the three kinds of questions that we use in each case. Now we won't stop and ask if you have any questions at every juncture here, but if you have questions, feel free to ask them. Try to clarify matters for you. All right, so that's one of the primary laws operative here. So let me say this about the postscript in this book and in other epistles, although as we indicated yesterday, this is a sort of epistle treatise here, though against one of those books which are more properly called epistles. The relationship of the postscript to the rest of the epistle depends on the contents of the postscript. Sometimes those contents are not particularly germane to the rest of the epistle. In other words, for example, if an author adds a series of greetings, those greetings would have been given no matter what he said in the epistle. So there's no organic relationship between the postscript and the epistle in that case. In other cases, you do have an organic relationship. For example, an author might, in a postscript, indicate the purpose of a letter, in which case instrumentation would be very significant. I think that's the case, for example, in Romans. Romans 16, which is the postscript in Romans, contains something of the purpose of the letter. So the relationship between this and the rest of the epistle depends on the contents of the postscript. And in this case, one of the factors one has to keep in mind has to do with where the postscript begins. And there's a difference of opinion here. Because in 20 and 21, you have a benediction. You recognize that benediction. It's the one that we often use in worship. Postscripts often contain benedictions. And indeed, in a sense, you have a benediction at the close of the book. So it might begin there, or it might begin here, which is where the RSV indicates it begins, by the break that you find in the text between verse 21 and 22. And there are arguments pro and con with regard to these two options. If it begins in 20 and 21, then there might be a relationship between the benediction and what he said in the epistle. Because of the uncertainty of that, we won't try to explore that more fully. We'll just indicate the possibility for you and have you explore it for yourselves further. Now let's look at the structure of the body of the book, which of course constitutes the bulk of the book, so the way in which the body is constructed, 1.5 through either 13.21 or 13.19, let's say 13.21 would follow the RSV break. the body, the structure of the body, obviously in view of its substantial material, as far as the entire unit is concerned, book unit, is very significant for the book as a whole. Let's look at that structure, and let's begin at least by getting some of your contributions here, and as far as we have time, see what they are, and get some reaction to them, analysis of them, so we help you both by way of enabling you better to survey books at other times, but also by way of helping you better to understand the book of Hebrews as a whole. Let me ask, and we'll do this on a volunteer basis at this stage, would you please name one of the primary laws you found and the materials that you used that you found in the use of the law, and then ask constructive questions about that law and its materials? I wonder if you might have a volunteer. Carl?
Well, I have causation. From the first to the 1018. And I see this like the book of Romans. It's major doctrinal appeals, and then at the end of the exhortation.
All right, you're talking about the therefore of 1019, which indicates that what precedes is causal, and what succeeds is the effect of the preceding causes. All right, there is some similarity to Pauline books with regard to structure. There is, however, a difference between this book and Pauline books. Anybody notice a difference? What you're doing here is dividing this into two parts then, Charles, namely the doctrinal part through 1018, and then the portatory or ethical part in 1019 Pauline. Now, let's analyze that. Do you find evidence that might indicate there's a difference between that kind of structure, which is a common Pauline structure, outside of, say, the pastorals, in which case the entire epistle is hortatory. For example, you take 2 Timothy, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, the whole thing involves a series of exhortations. But normally in Paul's writings, the more major writings, you have that kind of breakdown in terms of units and structure. Now, let's analyze that and see if that holds here, too. Let's have some dialogue between Charles and others. Sam, how would you respond?
I had a difficulty to find the clear two portions of exposition and interpretation, because I was thinking that wrong too, but like chapter 11 is a clear exposition of chapter, and chapter 3 and chapter 4 contains numerous interpretations. So it's like Romans, even though chapter 6 has the exhortation part, it's clear that exhortation comes out of the exposition, and the continuing flow of the style is completely expositional. But this type is hard to see the clear to block the material.
Okay, what Sam is saying then, Charles, is that perhaps you have exhortations prior to 1019 following. And the question is whether they are major exhortations, and whether they are subordinate to the flow of argument, which is true, for example, of Romans 6 in relation to the argument of Romans 1 to 11, or whether they are not major breaks in the argument in terms of the flow of thought. Now let me ask, where does the first exhortation appear?
Chapter 2, 2-1.
That's the first exhortation, with a therefore, by the way. And that's an implicit exhortation, but clearly an exhortation. Therefore, we must pay the closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it.
What about the possibility of blocking it in two by using substantiation and saying that what goes up to chapter 7 verse 28 is substantiation of Christ as the high priest, and then from 8:1 and following is the cause which substantiates the cause of our faith and trust in him and the motivation of our surrender to him. Is that possible to break it there at chapter 8?
Well, you still have a discussion of the superiority of Christ, and not only as high priest, but in other respects in 8:1 following, don't you? So what I'm saying is that I think you've hit on a key element here, Charles, on causation, and the causal link between argument and exhortation The question is whether it breaks the material down into the units you've indicated. Now, let's explore that further. What are other possibilities here that are along similar lines, but not precisely the same as what you've indicated? Yes, Tyler.
Other than dividing the material, could we call it recurrence and causation?
All right. Let me add one other element, which involves recurrence, but involves a more precise pattern of alternation, and that is causation by interchange with regard to the hortatory pattern. Now, there are some differences of opinion as to where these argumentative units stop and the exhortation picks up, but there is a possibility that what you have is the movement back and forth as between argument and exhortation, which is quite different from Pauline materials. Now, in the hortatory materials, you have substantiation. That's a common device. In other words, what you have, for example, in 1:1 to 14, or if you want to look at the body of the material, 1:5 to 14, you have your argument. And then followed in 2:1 to 4 by exhortation. Within the hortatory materials, what you will often have, or in fact always have, with the exception of 13 in a number of cases, we have a whole series of exhortations, only some of which are substantiated, is substantiation, or it could be in the form of causation. In other words, within the hortatory materials themselves, you have either the pattern, the exhortation is given, followed by a substantiation of it, or sometimes, within the hortatory materials, you'll have causal statements followed by the exhortation, or sometimes you'll have both. Let's illustrate that, for example, at that point of that first hortatory unit, namely 2:1 to 4, to which we referred. Therefore, of course, that indicates your causal link. Okay? We must pay closer attention to what we've heard, lest we drift away from it. Four indicates what?
Substantiation.
For if the message declared by angels, and note, by the way, that in this passage that you'll be looking at for tomorrow, there is a continuation of the angel motif, which is dominant in 1:4 to 14, as we shall see in studying the rest of chapter 1. For if the message declared by angels was valid, and every transgression or disobedience received a just retribution, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? Etc. So there you have substantiation within the hortatory unit. Now sometimes, as I say, the hortatory pattern will involve one of the following possibilities. Either it begins with the exhortation, you have only exhortation. Let's take a look at 13, this final unit. Here, which is part of that hortatory material. We'll see how that is the case. For example, in 13:1, you have an exhortation. That's brotherly love continue. In 13:2, you have a second exhortation. Note, by the way, that some of these are positive, some of these are negative. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. Now you have a substantiation in 2b. For, thereby, some have entertained angels, come back to angels, unawares. Remember those who are in prison, as though in prison with them, and those who are ill-treated. Now, by the way, in the first case, you don't have substantiation. You really have simply comparison, indicating a standard. In the second case, in 3b, you have substantiation, and those who are ill-treated, since you also are in the body. Since is a synonym for for in that case. Look at some of the other exhortations. Say in 17, obey your leaders and submit to them, for, substantiation, they are keeping watch over your souls as men who will have to give account. So sometimes you have just the exhortation, as we explained. Sometimes you have the exhortation followed by substantiation. Sometimes you have exhortation preceded by causation. Sometimes you'll have exhortation both preceded by causation and followed by substantiation. Now, those are your four hortatory patterns. Remember that, you'll have a way of analyzing hortatory materials. Do you have those?
No.
One, either just the exhortation, plain exhortation, as you have in 13:1. Two, exhortation followed by substantiation, as you have in 13.2. Three, exhortation preceded by causation, by causes. Now, the same structural principles are at work, you understand? Causation and substantiation are like particularization and generalization. That is to say, in both cases, the same two components are involved. The question is simply one of sequence. In other words, in causation, you move from cause to effect. And I'm using the singular. You can have plural in either or both cases. Cause to effect, that's causation. Substantiation simply reverses the order. You move from effect to cause. And by the way, as we've seen, when substantiation is expressed, such conjunctions as for, since, because, etc. are used. When causation is expressed, we've seen in the text, therefore, then, thus, consequently, etc. are used. But the same structural principle is involved. It's just a matter of the sequence of these components here. So actually, it's the same principle involved, but when you analyze these things, break them down into their components, and you want to make sure you know what the exhortation is, and what is not hortatory, but causation and or substantiation. And the fourth option is that you have both causation and substantiation. So those are your four possible patterns in hortatory materials. Now we'll be, we don't want to take more time.
Preceded by both?
No, it can't be preceded by both. And where you have a combination here, you have it preceded by causes and followed by reasons. Supporting reasons, so that would be my substantiation. That means supporting reasons, substantiated reasons. Do you have a question or comment? Yeah.
You're saying then that the argument here is really the cause for doing what the exhortation says.
Right.
I didn't do it like that, but I thought I saw an interchange pattern. It was your exhortations are really warnings there, and I say they're interchanging warnings, but I called the other part contrast, and it's the Son or Jesus was being contrasted with various persons.
Yeah. Well, what you're doing now is getting into the structure of the arguments. Okay, what you've done is to identify the exhortations as warnings, and that's the proper identification of them. But in terms of structure, it's exhortations, which may be of various sorts. In this particular case, there are exhortations of warning. So if you want to identify them in terms of the general label, which really implies that the imperative mood, or what is synonymous to the imperative mood, is being used. In other words, you have a call to action of some sort. Okay. Here, we in 2.1, the call to action is not to neglect or drift away from this salvation. Okay. And the argument may be of a certain sort. It may vary depending on the particular book. So you want to identify the materials argumented, which is indicative, by the way. So you have the indicative followed by the imperative, flowing from the imperative. Now, we'll be looking at the structure of the argument here in just a moment. In fact, we'll look at the structure of both the argument and the exhortation. By the way, there's a link between the causation you have here, which connects the argument with the exhortations, and whatever you have by way of causation and substantiation within the hortatory materials themselves. In other words, within these units, you have the same kind of thing at work as you have between these units. See? Namely, causation. Now, we'll find that what you have in hortatory materials, when you have something beyond a simple exhortation, namely, when you have reason for the exhortation, followed by the exhortation, or reason supporting the exhortation, you'll have one of the following phenomena. One, you'll have either repetition, in a sense, of causes already given in the argumentative portions. In other words, the author may well restate what he's already said, the argumented portions. Now, sometimes he'll do it in other words, so that he isn't saying precisely what he said already, but It's there in essence. And that's precisely what you have, by the way, in 2:1-4, because actually what he says in 2 following, in terms of the message declared by angels being valid, etc., really is a statement based on what he said in 1:1-14. Particularly 1:4-14. So that he is really restating an argument already used. Or he may give additional arguments, or new arguments, additional reasons, which he hasn't stated in this material. So we want to look at what the author does to see how it's related in these hortatory units to the argument which precedes the hortatory material. Now, by the way, what happens in all this is that the reasoning is cumulative. In other words, when we say that here you have argument, here you have exhortation, and then argument again and exhortation here, we're not saying that this argument is causal only with regard to this exhortation. And then you have a sort of dividing line. Now he begins a new argument, which is causal only with regard to this exhortation. But actually, all of these arguments ultimately build up and are causal with regard particularly to the final exhortations. So you have a cumulative effect here in the argument with regard to these materials. Now, with that in mind, let's ask a series of questions here. Before we do, let me go back now to what you said, Charles. You see why one might reason that you have a different kind of pattern here from what you have in many of the Pauline books. And by the way, this is one reason why there's questions to whether this is really Pauline. It does not follow the usual Pauline pattern as far as the major books are concerned. But the principle, the basic principle you found is valid. Now, when you have cause and effect, what you need to do is ask questions about each component and, of course, how they're related to each other. First, the causal component. What are the main points in each argumentative unit? What do they mean? By the way, when you ask what is here, that's really an observational question, not an interpretive question. When you ask what do they mean, you're interpreting. But you have to identify before you can interpret. And that's why I often combine those two questions with each other. What is the meaning of each of the hortatory units? That's your effect. Then, your relationship, how do the exhortations flow from the argument? So what's the causal link there? How are the exhortations the effect of the argument? Why, and now we're moving to the rational kind of question, why does the author use certain arguments as a basis for his exhortations? Why does he make the exhortations he does? And that often gets you into the occasion for writing, the problems that people are facing, which the author is addressing. Then, when you have recurring elements, and interchange is a form of recurrence, is a more precise form of recurrence than recurrence, you ought to ask about relationships between these recurring elements. Are there recurring elements in the arguments and exhortations? Are there certain things that come up over and over again? They give you a clue to the major thrust of the author. That's an observational question. Say, if so, what are they, and why are they used recurringly? That's your rational question, based on the observation, if it's there. And then here's a question about interchange. Why does the author use an alternating pattern of argument and exhortation? Why doesn't he simply use arguments solely up until a certain point, as Paul commonly does, and then start at that point with exhortation, reserve against using this alternating pattern, so this is the why of the interchange, and then what may be inferred from the answer to these questions. That's another form of implication question. Now, you see how sweeping these questions are, and they are such that if you eventually answer these questions, you will have gotten the book as a whole. Say nothing of the various parts of the book. I say the book as a whole, I mean the whole book and the book as a whole. Okay, any questions there? I wish we could leave these transparencies up here longer, but we simply don't have the time to do that. As I say, the main reason for using them is simply to reinforce what we're saying orally. Or in lieu of taking all the time to write these on the board, in which case we'd have to be writing and erasing and writing and erasing. This gives us not really much more visual presentation. Yes, ma'am.
About the specific material, you listed chapter 3, verse 1, which is a strong exhortation in the argumentative portion.
Yeah.
So you interpret this portion as part of the argumentative.
Yes. Yes. I hesitate to get into the reason why I've done what I've done, because I don't want to anticipate what you do and look at the passage yourself. But let me address this one portion. And what you need to do is test out whether my breakdown is valid. As I indicated to begin with, there are some questions as to where the argumentative portions end and the hortatory portions begin. But the reason why I would include the material in 3:1 following in the argumentative portions over against the hortatory portion is that though technically you have an exhortation there, the exhortation simply is another way of saying what he's been saying all along in the argument, that's look at Jesus. Okay. So it's technically an exhortation, but for all intents and purposes what he's simply doing is continuing the argument about Jesus, at whom he's asking them to look, whom he's asking them to consider. So that's where you have to deviate from the principle that the moment you find an imperative or its counterpart, then a hortatory unit begins. That's not always true. That's a rule of thumb. But you have to, I take it you had time to copy these units down. I think we left that on the board long enough to copy those units. You'll have to test that out for yourselves. And that points up the fact that a survey is tentative and needs to be tested on the basis of the examination of the parts. And needs to be completed if it's incomplete on the basis of the examination of the parts. So it may even be corrected and or completed on the basis of examination of parts. So don't worry about coming up with a final, which means completely correct and absolutely final, complete survey of a book at the survey stage. So that simply begins a process, which then needs to be tested and finalized at synthesis. There is where you make your final judgments as to whether your survey that made the book, say for example, these units that we initially gave us during the interpretation are really valid, or whether there are other breakdowns, or whether there are other ways of looking at the book, not involved in a particular approach. Now, what we're going to find in just a moment, is that we'll begin answering the question about recurring elements by way of finding units here. So what we'll find here is that you don't have, for example, by way of indicating distinct arguments, exhortation, argument A here, which we'll call 1, followed by exhortation A, followed by argument 2, which is completely different from 1, followed by exhortation 2, which is completely different from the previous exhortation, etc. But rather there are links between these things. Now, one of the links has to do with a third law that I would mention, and that is the recurrence of contrast. Now, this, I think, is what you were talking about, Fred, with regard to both the arguments and the exhortations. The recurrence of contrast, and that's seen in part by the use of better and its synonyms. And I've given you references where you have this concept of better used, and of course, that's the thing he says immediately in 1:1-4. The revelation in the Son is better than the revelation of old times past by the prophets. And that motif of contrast between the two covenants is a recurring motif, and it emerges in terms of many, many contrasts. The Son versus previous revelation, the Son, Jesus versus the angels, versus Moses, the order of Melchizedek, versus the Aaronic order, the heavenly sanctuary versus the earthly sanctuary, the new covenant versus the old covenant, Jesus sacrifices versus animal sacrifices, etc. That's the common element that you find both in these arguments and in these exhortations. And that's what ultimately holds this together, as over against simply having a string of arguments and exhortations which are quite distinct from each other. Now, you could have that kind of book. You could have a book in which an author simply gives you different arguments and exhortations strung along together. There are books of that sort. The pattern that that is followed in some of the other New Testament books are at least implicitly of this sort.